Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Our guest has been delayed a little bit, but we will hope that she joins us in just a few minutes. And meanwhile, I'm going to play you a little bit of information about our sponsor. This program is brought to you each week by the VHL Family Alliance. VHL stands for von Hippel-Lindau disease, and it's one of the many complex medical conditions that people can have. So we've learned a lot about living with a complex medical condition and wanted to share some of that information with you and learn from the other complex medical conditions that are out there. So feel free to ask us to talk about your situation. We'd be glad to do that at any time. So right now, let me play you a little bit of information about VHL, and we'll be back in 1 minute, hopefully, to talk with our guests. Thank you.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Hi, everybody. So let me tell you a little bit about von Hippel-Lindau disease while we're waiting for Susan Levin to join us. So von Hippel-Lindau is just one little bitty change in one gene, and because of that change, some of the chemistry in the body doesn't work quite as the way it was expected to work, and tumors can form in the retina, brain, spinal cord, kidney, pancreas, and adrenal glands. That's a lot of different organ systems, and so it is one of those, as we say, complex medical conditions. If you're dealing with more than one medical specialist, then that means it's complex. And partly because in our medical system, you get to manage those multiple specialists. So dealing with those multiple specialists is sometimes quite a challenge. And they don't always talk to one another, and sometimes you have to carry your scans across town and so forth. So it gives you a more active role in your medical care. But the bottom line really is that while your doctor has a couple thousand patients, you have one body, and the person who's going to know your body the best and be most motivated to take care of it is, in fact, yourself. And so you really can't get out of that job. You really don't want to get out of that job, even though sometimes you think you want to get out of that job. But, in fact, you're your best resource. And of course, it's always helpful if you have a friend who's along with you in doing that and making sure that things are going well. So whenever you have to go to the doctor, you should always take a friend or a notebook or a tape recorder or something so that you can capture the whole of the discussion with the doctor. And the reason for that is that when we're in the hot seat, when it's our life at stake, we sometimes will space out in the middle of a session with a doctor. We don't mean to, but it's a self-protective thing that our bodies do for us. They just kind of say, you've had enough today, kid. I think we're going to just shut down. So you don't always remember everything that was discussed. So if you have a friend, or if you've taken notes, or if you have that recorder with you, then you're more likely to be able to go back through the notes or listen to the tape and have a discussion with your friend, and you'll get the whole value out of that conversation. The other thing you should do is you should always prepare for a session with a doctor, because figure it's like you have 10 minutes with the CEO of some corporation and you've been working 6 months to get this appointment. You want to make sure that in that 10 minutes you accomplish your goal, right? So you're going to need to prepare and figure out what are the questions you need to ask, what's the most effective way to phrase those questions so that they'll be heard properly and that, you know, they're not going to take offense and they're going to give you the answers that you're looking for. And you should prepare in that same way for your doctor's visit. Make sure you write it down. Don't just try to memorize it, because I promise you it will fly right out of your brain when you're sitting there in that paper nightie on the examining table. So write it down. Keep notes. Don't be shy to do that. It really is the best way to prepare for a meeting. Well, I've been hoping to talk with Susan Levin, who is from New Jersey. She is the founder of a group called the Lung Cancer Circle of Hope. And one of the things that I have read about her, and in the preparatory conversations I had with her, one of her goals was to try to reduce the stigma of having lung cancer, because lung cancer is one of those diseases that when someone says, "Oh, I've been diagnosed with lung cancer," what's the first question that people say to them? How long have you smoked? So the immediate thought on the part of someone who hears you have lung cancer is that you sort of did it to yourself, that it's a lifestyle choice that you made and that you did it to yourself. But in fact, it's not always true. One of the fastest growing segments of people with lung cancer are people who have never smoked, who have inhaled other people's smoke, that secondhand smoke that they talk about. And as a matter of fact, now they're talking about a phenomenon called third-hand smoke, where you get it not just from other people who are smoking in your face or in your environment, but from their clothing or their hair. Or when someone smokes, it clings to all the fabric in the environment, whether the wearer of that fabric is in fact a smoker or not. So you get it into your clothes, you get it into the carpet, you get it into the sofa or the drapes, and you walk into a room that may be totally empty and you're breathing tobacco. The other insidious thing about tobacco is that this is an industry which in America has raised a lot of money. It's been important as a cash crop in many parts of the United States. And so even after it had been identified as a source of cancer-promoting activity, it continued to be protected. The tobacco industry was protected by its legislators, both within its primary states and outside of its primary states. And so states like North Carolina and Virginia, where tobacco was an essential part of the economy, they didn't want to see that economic boon done away with. And the whole reality of lung cancer really didn't hit us until the last couple of decades here. I was in North Carolina for a meeting of the National Cancer Institute not too long ago, and they put up a slide where they talked about the different kinds of cancers that they see at the University of North Carolina Cancer Center. And each one of these little bars on the bar graph was, you know, maybe an inch or two high. And so you'd say breast and prostate and so forth and so forth. And then the lung cancer bar was higher than the sum of all the other cancers that occur in North Carolina. So it wasn't just bigger, it was phenomenal compared to other cancers. So lung cancer is very, very high in these states that have been great producers of tobacco. And the whole tobacco industry has been of two minds. You know, obviously they wanted to make money for their investors, they wanted to make money for their employees, but they began to become aware, or various people within those corporations began to become aware of the addictive quality of smoking. And the extent to which they leveraged that capability on the part of the product to expand their market is something that, you know, in corporate terms, in one sense is admirable, and in the other sense is really horrible because they really victimized people. And one of the things that really began to get to the American public was the use of, do you remember Joe Camel on the advertising? They started aiming at young teenagers and using cartoonish figures to appeal to young teens and expand their market into younger and younger people. So they've really worked hard to try to get people to buy and use their product. And the other thing that's only begun to be appreciated now is the extent to which over the last 20, 30 years they've been adding additives to tobacco products to make it more addictive. And so that's really not at all nice. It's not just regular merchandising inventiveness, but is really inimical to the population. So there's more and more pressure now on the tobacco companies to quit recruiting people to buy their product. And the companies themselves are highly diversified now. So people like Philip Morris do a whole lot more than just tobacco. They're in many, many foodstuffs and so forth. They're highly diversified. So if their tobacco business went away, the whole corporation will feel less hurt than ever before. The other thing they've done, though, is to go into other countries and recruit new purchasers of the product in other countries where the laws are not as much against smoking as they are here and now more and more in Europe. But there are many countries in which tobacco is not regulated yet and where they are trying very hard to make inroads. So it's really difficult, and particularly when we look at things like advertising and recruiting new places where they can sell their product. This has been the goal of all American businesses. You know, if you own a hamburger stand, you're trying to sell more hamburgers. If you had a lemonade stand, you're trying to sell more lemonade. And so it's the normal thing for a business entrepreneur to try to do. But when we determine that the product is harmful, then we recall cars, we recall foods, we recall pharmaceuticals that may have a flaw in them that could be harmful to other people. But look how long it took us to try to halt the spread of smoking. And it's still out there, and it's still very difficult to control. So one of the things that I come back to are, how many other things are we allowing companies to market to ourselves, to our children, that are really not beneficial, if not actively detrimental to the people who are using the product? Things like cereals with too much sugar in them, or prepared foods with too much sugar, too much salt. And these days, one of the big new things is high fructose corn syrup. We have determined that one of the primary reasons for the level of obesity in America is because of the amount of high fructose corn syrup that there is in prepared foods. But we're still advertising it, and lately, if you notice on the television ads, there's an active effort on the part of the manufacturers of such foods to make us believe that there's nothing wrong with high fructose corn syrup. They have these ads about, oh, I did my research, and the body really can't tell the difference. Sugar is sugar. If it's corn syrup or if it's cane sugar, the body can't tell the difference. Well, in fact, the body can tell the difference. The research is not in tune with those statements, and people are lying to us on the air. And there is no regulation of that. There's no way that we can say, you don't get to say statements that are unproven or false. In some realms, we're very heavy-handed about that. So, for example, we don't allow the drug manufacturers to make statements that are not proven. We make them write down all of the downsides of their drug. I love the ads on television where they say, oh, Are you feeling down when you're in company? This drug will improve your social life. And then they begin in a fast, low-tone voice to rattle off all the disclaimer information, the, you know, fine print stuff. And one of the things there is that it may improve your social life, but it could wreck your sex life at the same time. So there is a downside to most of these new products. It's whether or not they're being allowed to tell us or being required to tell us about the downside. You'll see more and more scary placards on the sides of cigarette boxes because now they're going to have gruesome pictures and things like that. We will see if that helps. Traditionally, it has not helped, and particularly if you've worked hard for the last 30 years to make sure that people are so addicted to your product that it will be almost impossible for them to quit. You can raise the price as much as you want. You can put ugly pictures on the package, but the chance that they're going to stop buying the product because of these pictures is probably pretty low. What they can hope to do is to stop new people from picking up the product. And if that were able to happen, that would help a little bit. It would certainly be a benefit. But the chance that you're going to take a long-term smoker and get them to stop smoking because of these warnings is probably slim to none. So we have to not only say yes to lifestyle choice, we also have to say they were lured into that choice by advertising and movies, which 40, 50 years ago used to tell us that smoking was sexy, smoking would make you more sophisticated, it was an elegant thing to do. And now we don't believe that, but in those days that was the message. And the Marlboro man sitting on his horse looking very macho had to, of course, have a cigarette in his hand. The elegant women from the 1930s with cigarettes and long, what do they call those things? The little extender things, you know, that made them really long, so they'd have this foot-long thing with a cigarette on the end that was supposedly making them more sophisticated. They never talked about how your breath smelled and how your clothes reeked and so forth. But it's interesting now that many of the public buildings, if not most, are disallowing smoking. We walk into an area and we can immediately tell if someone's been smoking or not because we now expect air to be cleaner. And when we walk into a room where it's not clean, we notice the difference. So even smokers are noticing that difference. I spend a lot of time in hotels because I travel a good bit, and I've watched this evolution in hotels over the last 20 years. So before, people would smoke in most rooms, right? And then they went through a time of saying, well, we'll make some rooms non-smoking. But that was almost a losing battle because people would say, sure, I'll take that room, and then they'd smoke it in anyway. Sometimes you'd go into a non-smoking room and there'd be an ashtray sitting there. So that, too, was a losing battle. So then they went to, we'll have a smoking floor and a non-smoking floor. And what transpired was that the smoking floors got so awful. They smelled, you know, like the old Greyhound buses before they disallowed smoking. So you'd walk into that room and you could scarcely breathe, right? So even the smokers were requesting a non-smoking room and then smoking in it. So then I began seeing signs about, if you smoke in this room, there'll be a $250 cleanup fee added to your bill. So that worked, I suppose, for a little while. Now I see more and more hotels going to smoke-free. A whole building, every place, you cannot smoke in the building. And that seems to be more successful because it's easier to perceive. If anyone smokes, you notice it immediately because of the change in the atmosphere. So what is it about this stuff? It provides an irritant in our lungs that generates an immune reaction on the part of our bodies that can lead to cancer, can lead to long-term inflammation, and can lead to cancer. And again, it's not just the smoke that you yourself are creating with the smoking that you do, but remember that around you, your children, your family, and your colleagues are all getting a secondhand dose of that same smoke. So it's really a difficult thing. You can't really keep it to yourself. When I was in Scandinavia visiting, oh, when was that, 20 years ago, they had already outlawed smoke in all public places, which included the out-of-doors. So anybody who really was still addicted to nicotine and wanted to have their dose of nicotine had to do it with chewing tobacco. And one of my husband's cousins was walking around with a chaw in his mouth the whole time and, you know, would discreetly spit every once in a while and be done with the juice. But he had this little can, which I hadn't seen since the 1950s, you know, little cans that looks a little like a shoe polish can that you could buy in the gasoline stations. There'd be rows and rows of these little cans. And he'd have that, put it in his pocket, and stick a piece in his mouth. Well, I mean, that does cut down on secondhand smoke. It's much better for the secondhand smokers. It's, in fact, worse for the smoker, if you will, the person who's using this chewing tobacco, because you have it sitting right next to your gum, and the likelihood that you're going to get a cancer in your mouth or your tongue is very high. So it does tend to at least limit the damage to the person who's doing it and not to the people around them, but it still is a really bad thing for the people who are using these tobacco products. So what's the solution to it? I know years ago they tried putting really nasty-looking pictures in the post offices in the UK. They had pictures of gunked-up lungs and awful things in the post offices, and the feedback from it was that it made people so anxious that smokers looking at those pictures felt like they needed to smoke. They go directly outside and light up, because people do use smoking as a way of managing their stress. And so there's a feedback loop in there, you know. You can't just say, well, stop smoking. There has to be some support in stopping smoking, both because it is a chemical addiction, just as much as morphine or any other chemical addiction. These additives in particular, as well as the nicotine, are addictive. The system gets used to them. When you take them away, the system gets unhappy, and so your body feels wrong, feels completely ugly, and you want it not to feel that way, and so you go and have a smoke. But there are now nicotine patches and other things that can assist people in giving up the smoking. And so we need to encourage people to do it, but not blame them. You really can't shame people into it. You can't blame them into it. You can love them into it a lot more readily. So let them know that you care about them. You don't want them to be hurt. And you know that it's a difficult problem. It's a problem that they have not created by themselves, that they may have picked up that cigarette, but the tobacco companies worked very hard to make it impossible for them to put it down. So hopefully with the right supports, more and more people can, in fact, give up smoking. There are laws now about restaurants and workplaces to try to make sure that secondhand smoke damage is limited, but it does mean that the people who work there now are being required to quit smoking, and there have actually been some legal challenges to that. How can you require somebody to give up smoking? There was a challenge recently because a workplace had disallowed someone smoking at home. And while you can disallow smoking in the workplace, do you have a right to disallow smoking at home? Well, if that person is smoking outside of the building and it gets into their hair, their clothes, etc., and then they walk into the building, they're actually carrying that third-hand smoke with them into the building. So it's a more subtle version, but it still is a problem. It smells bad, and it is bringing that inhalant into an environment where other people are forced to breathe it. So It's a difficult question, and one that we as a society really have to face. And how can we do this in fairness to the people who did not intentionally addict themselves, but it wound up doing that, and or the people who, I mean, picture someone who doesn't smoke but who is married to a smoker. Then not only is that person being subjected to the smoke, but they are carrying that third-hand smoke into their workplace, wherever that may be. So one of these days we'll get that together. But the other thing that I look at is, what lessons can we learn about preventing something like this happening in the future? Because in an entrepreneurial society, there is a danger that somebody will do something that is good for them, but not good for the other people around them. And what can we learn about how to control that, or can we control that? And the other thing is, what can we learn about what we should and should not permit on the public airwaves? So there are things about products that are not so good for us. There are also things about free speech that are not always good for us. There used to be balance on the public airways, that if a person with one view held forth for a half hour, then the opposing view was supposed to be given equal airtime, at least certainly in the presidential campaigns and things like that. Now that's not done so much. And so in some cases you have one opinion dominating on the public airways, and do the listeners have the discrimination to tell that this is in fact a colored viewpoint? It's not an even-handed review of the press or whatever. It is in fact colored with their particular opinion. So we as consumers really have to be circumspect, because we're not always being told both sides of the question. And we need to be more careful as consumers, because what's printed on the label or what's told us in the ad is not always the truth. So it's a difficult question, and one that I had hoped to speak with Susan about, but since Susan didn't come, I've had the opportunity to speak with all of you about it, and glad to have your feedback and opinions about it. So please do write to info@powerfulpatient.org, and let me know what you think. And also, if there are other topics that you'd like to talk about, we can do that at another time. So thank you very much for joining me today, and I hope that you'll be with us next week as well. It's pretty summery here in Boston, and we have a lot of work that we're catching up on. I hope that you're doing the same and maybe having some time in the sunshine and getting some rest. And yes, sunshine in small doses can be good for you. I actually went to Florida and I came back with a mild tan, which for somebody who's as much of a pale face as me is saying something. So small doses of sunshine are good for you. Heavy doses of sunshine are not good for you. So use that time in the sun and the protections from the wrong waves of the sun. Use those carefully. And be well. And be sure to be with us again next week. And we will see you then. So everybody have a good time in the next week. And be well. And be a powerful patient. Thanks so much for being here. Bye.